Please hold whilst we connect you to Redacted.
This is Lisa Bishop.
And this is Fraser Greenfield.
This is Lauren Menard.
And this is Bailey Mishler.
And you're listening to Redacted.
Today, we are joined by Lauren and Bailey from Prowl. Prowl is a dynamic and forward-thinking research and design studio that has been challenging the status quo in design and materials since 2021. Based out of San Francisco, California, USA, the team at Prowl has been making vital steps to ensure products aren't doing less bad, but the most good. Could you guys give us an elevator pitch on who Prowl is in 100 words or less?
Prowl is an industrial design and research studio creating new solutions for people and the planet by employing materials, processes, technology more responsibly. Our goal as a studio is to reorient the world of industrial design to achieve a regenerative future. And a mantra we live and breathe by is we begin with the end, which really encapsulates this holistic, thoughtful approach that we take to all of our work.
What do you mean by you begin with the end? Does that mean you start with the product's end of its life or the manufacturing?
Essentially, when we started our studio, we knew that we wanted to do so with the lens towards responsible design, really, really hone in on what that means. We figured that we had to look at the inevitable end that every industrial designer doesn't want to think about. But whenever our product that we design ends up being no longer relevant and obsolete or broken or whatever its end may look like, we needed to look at that as inspiration for doing better, because that's the place where most of the time products do the most bad, which is when they're done with, they just go to landfill, they leach chemicals, and they just harm people and planet for the rest of their existence, which sometimes is 500 years. So what we do is we start a design process by being inspired by that moment and how we can improve upon that along with the life that it lives when it's relevant and useful.
Did that come from a personal experience where you saw something you designed that was abandoned or before then?
I think we both had interesting observations throughout our careers that led to this. For me personally, while I'm really proud of my career prior to Prowl, it definitely had me witnessing so much waste, just like dumpsters full of unwanted product, prototypes, samples, etc., that just had me questioning if this was it and that there had to be a better way and a better purpose for what I was putting my time towards.
Would you say that you're looking to change the dynamic that real designers pollute?
What we're saying is that designers have a responsibility to think about that portion of a life cycle. And you can't just think about the beautiful, sexy beginning. You have to think about the end.
Because I do know that there was this mantra that real designers ship. And someone once told me that real designers pollute. There's nothing you can do to get around that. You can just minimize how real you are in that. We're creating future archaeology.
I hate that so much. There's just so much baked in there that's such a God complex, an ego.
I don't know if they were saying this with a sense of ego. It's definitely more of a sense of macabre responsibility. But maybe winding back a bit, how did you guys first discover your field?
For me, I definitely was interested in the arts pretty much my whole life. I mean, what I thought I was going to do meandered, as I think it often does as you're growing up. And I chose to go to school at the Cleveland Institute of Art in Ohio, thinking I was going to pursue something like illustration or advertising, still in applied arts. But I really didn't even know what industrial design was until I got to school. And it was offered as a program, and I got to taste test it with an elective class where you got to experience a major you thought you wanted to go into before you went into it. And it was in that that I really learned first and foremost what it was and really fell in love with the problem-solving, methodical approach to the discipline that I'd never really seen in any other art or creative field up until that point. There was this structure and measurable outcome to what you were doing.
Was there a magical key moment where you realized this is for you?
Or an object you saw and you were just like, yes.
I wouldn't say it was an object. My desire to put my skills towards something bigger than me was baked into this exact moment as well, even though my career wasn't fully exercising it until Prowl. But one of the projects we were asked to do in that elective was to think about a post-tragedy set. Imagine you had to evacuate your home for some reason. What are some things that you might have readily available for you to survive that first week, a grab bag of sorts? Thinking through all these objects and problem solving through this extreme scenario you could find yourself in, it was through that process alone that I was like, oh man, this is it for me. And of course, that's now taken a different shape through our practice at Prowl. But I think seeing how you could have an impact on a situation or a person through design itself, all those things coming together in that moment was really the genesis for me.
That's such an interesting way to introduce industrial design to people as well. Like, I've never heard that type of first day at the class situation.
It wasn't just like doing some hot sketches of shoes or something, which is also really great and awesome. But that was not my intro, which maybe is just such kudos to my education and the people who ran my program.
Absolutely. I feel like it really highlights the part of industrial design that people don't talk a lot about, which is almost every object is a remix of something that's come before it, contextualized in a new way to make it more useful or new features or maybe more sustainable.
Is there a teacher that you wanted to give a shout out to?
All of them.
That is the most Bailey answer of all time.
Your university experience must have been a bit different to mine.
Well, when I think about my building within the program once I was in it, I think there were two professors that really, really stand out to me. One was head of the department, Dan Cafaro, who through every year, he was really leading a lot of the curriculum and building a lot of the philosophies that I carry with me to date. And the other, who was really instrumental in jumpstarting my career at large, was Doug Page. He was someone who innately had a real deep love of the outdoors and really thinking holistically about the problems you were solving. And he's the one who introed me to Robert Arco. He goes by Bob, who became a real mentor of mine through school. And he was a former creative director at Coalesce, which is where Lauren and I met and what initiated my career in furniture, which is something else I really fell in love with in school.
What about you, Lauren? How did you discover industrial design?
This is very telling of our personalities. We call ourselves this T-shaped partnership, which it may be a term you have or have not heard, but Bailey's gone the very deep route. She found industrial design, knew that was right, and committed her life to it. I, on the other hand, would argue that maybe I still haven't found ID because I almost don't even consider myself an industrial designer. So if we're talking about education, I have no degree. I went to 3 schools. I constantly felt like I wasn't finding anything that was scratching my itch. I started in fashion in New York City. I noticed really quick, also because a professor told me that I should go find something else to do because I was too excited about hardware on clothing. Found myself wanting to take a more academic route and went to a school called RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. It's the school of inventors. It's where the carousel was invented. It's where many different things that go into space have been invented. Deeply, deeply rooted in technical engineering. And I studied under someone there called Bert Swerzy in a program he created called Design Innovation in Society. I think it has a different name now, but that program bred these hybrid people. You had to be a dual major. And my dual major was another long-winded name called Science, Technology, and Society. So I found myself constantly being tied to these really hard to describe, hard to put in a box spaces that were solving big problems. So I studied different types of renewable energy in conjunction with materials. and then using those to solve social issues. Then I got restless. I moved to the West Coast for a number of reasons, made furniture for a while. And then I think now I'm in this middle ground in my career through obviously a decade of working after that. I've taken these avenues, and I'm sure lots of folks can relate to this, but I've taken these avenues through furniture, fashion, footwear, strategy, brand building, all sorts of different things, just because I go after what feels like a spark to me. And then I just go after that in that moment because I'm a super curious person. But the through line has always been the environment and materials. That's a long-winded way to say I don't really consider myself an industrial designer per se, but I'm more of a hybrid of sorts.
It sounds like a really powerful combination, though, being able to go from all that almost a material science background.
Yeah, I definitely learned how to communicate heavily scientific information while in school. It made me pretty good at distilling really complicated stuff with the help of people who are much smarter than me. And I think that's where Bailey and I find ourselves constantly, is we're smart in our own way, right? And we're problem solvers, but we work really well with people who have something that they've invented and they need to create something out of that that is culturally relevant and useful. And that's where we come in.
That's such a cool intersection to be in.
Yeah, I think so.
Very cool.
If you had to put yourself in a box, what would you call yourself?
Lauren cannot be boxed.
And your whole life breaking out of boxes. We're here to put you in one.
Professional box breaker?
I think I'm a builder.
I can work with that.
Yeah.
I would have also accepted a cat in a box.
I'm more of a dog.
Redacted.
Hey everyone, this episode is sponsored by PCBWay, the go-to destination for printed circuit board prototyping, low-volume production, and PCB assembly. If your team is working on electronics and you're in need of prototype PCBs, I can't recommend PCBWay enough. You can get a quote instantly, even if your circuit board schematics aren't finished yet. They can also help you with injection molded, 3D printed, sheet metal, and vacuum cast prototypes. PCBWay is the circuit board prototyper of choice for companies like Samsung, Siemens, Honeywell, Tesla, and Apple. But you don't have to be a big company to use their services. I've personally used their service to instantly get quotes to have prototype PCBs delivered in a timely manner. On top of that, PCBWay is so excited to be working with us. They're offering a special discount just for our listeners. When you get a quote from PCBWay, be sure to use the promo code REDACTED for a special discount on us. You can find PCBWay in our episode description or go to PCBWay.com.
Redacted. How did you decide you wanted to start your own studio, and what did the process look like?
Since we met, when we both were working for Coalesce, the furniture brand I mentioned earlier, that's really where our friendship and our professional journey started. And we stayed in touch over our 10 plus years in the field, and always hem-hawed about, oh, the what ifs and one days of founding something together, but it really didn't start taking shape of what it now is until much later, which Lauren really jump-started. And so I'm going to let her speak to that.
Pre-Prowl, I had maybe 5 stints at companies that were all 18 months long. And it was a matter of me going into companies, starting these internal brands or a satellite studio, or I was always building a new portion of the business and building a team around that. So I worked for a creative studio out of Vienna, starting their California studio here. I worked for a furniture company, a manufacturer based in Los Angeles, starting their Bay Area studio. And then right before starting Prowl, I was working at a high-end, really wild, handmade, custom concrete company. The owner, they were actually a client of mine, and the owner knew that I wanted to start my own business. I actually told him that I was going to be leaving the client relationship to start a business. And I described to him what that would look like. During this whole time, Bailey and I were talking about it as a partnership. She had to get married first, so she did that.
Yeah, I had some life stuff to get through before this.
And Steelcase was holding on tight. She had a really good thing going there. And I just kind of was like, all right, I'm going to do this thing. I went to this place called Concrete Works. I built out this internal brand called Manos Made, M-A-N-O-S, Made, handmade, but in Spanish, because everyone in the factory actually was native Spanish speaking. It was all about the handcraft of really beautiful physical products. Built the team around that. And my intention at that company was to go in and help them create carbon neutral products. And every time we would work with huge clients, some of the biggest tech brands in the world, Apple retail, for example, and work on these really big projects with companies you think would give a shit about making something more carbon neutral, and then have to compromise based on cost. It wasn't really the company's fault. It was just a number of variables. And Bailey and I both recognized that if we wanted to dedicate our lives to something more responsible, that we would have a greater effect on the world if we did so from the outside as consultants and the experts coming in, than trying to fight that fight from inside. Because when you do that from the inside, you have these very specific structures and budgets, and you have a hierarchy. And even at a director level, there was only so much that I could do. So now as consultants, we can come in, and when people bring us on, they know what they're getting themselves into. Well, most of the time. They know to a degree.
It's a happy surprise though, right?
I hope so. We're pretty nice people.
I think I'd just add, obviously there was part timing and our lives dovetailing into place to make this happen. And I would also just double click on the fact that we were getting to this place where so much of what we were witnessing and some of our frustrations around things we were dealing with in different roles we've had, we got to a place where almost we were fed up a bit. And we knew that we, as Lauren said, would have an impact if we started our own thing and really focused on adjusting our own design practice to be what we saw not happening in our roles up till that point, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah, definitely. Leading by example for everyone else. I just want to say Steelcase and Concrete Works really sound like companies for what people think industrial design is. Like, what industries are you making?
Very male-dominated spaces.
Yeah. Chalk and cheese for like where you've ended up.
Uh-huh.
That's a really interesting observation. No one's ever really brought that up before, but it's so true of their brand and how much maybe material, though. What I noticed there is how much materials kind of carried through with us. Both of these brand names have material right in it that definitely left some lasting impression on us.
And really industrial material.
Yeah, that was my first time working for a factory and really being on the factory floor during COVID even, which was really wild.
When you made this transition from your time at Concrete Works and Steelcase, what was your strategy in those early days?
Our strategy was to react to people we were talking to and get our messaging right. We thought that we could meet clients who had climate goals and climate pledges and these lofty ideas that they were trying to tackle, right? And come in and address it through product design. But what ended up happening was, for some reason, we kept having conversations with people and they wanted to start way upstream. They wanted us to help them build their strategy for their climate goals and how they were going to talk about that. So not only did we stretch our offering from the beginning of, we thought we would just be, you know, ID and then focus on furniture and focus on this niche little box, again, a box. Clearly, we can't be put in boxes because that has now been stretched. And I'm like doing this viscerally with my hands right now.
Imagining you as like a jack in a box, just bursting out.
And recognizing that, one, we're expert storytellers and hadn't really recognized that about ourselves until people started asking for it more because of the way that we educate through Prowl. and two, discovered that folks needed a little bit more support in going after those goals. I want to add that one of our biggest things in starting Prowl was we wanted to share free information on ideas that came up and topics that seem hot in the moment. Through our social media platform, we talk about what are bioplastics, what is greenwashing, what is carbon neutrality, and just break it down in simple terms. I think that our audience and our clients have seen that and want an element of that in their work. So almost like our branding has become a portion of what we offer.
It's eerie listening to that because your expansion of your services is almost exactly replicative of what happened to me when I started my own business. I had a background in designing products for recyclability. And when I got started, I found a lot of people ended up wanting me to map out this product strategy and the mathematics behind that on the carbon output. So I ended up spending as much time in Excel as I did on SolidWorks.
That's my nightmare.
It was interesting. I ended up doing a bunch of Q&As with some guys in the UK on what they called carbon accounting. And I was like, I've never heard this term before. It's just called maths, mate. It's what we don't want to do.
Just want to echo some things that Lauren said on the strategy. We've heard this ourselves, and I imagine you all have heard it as well in the number of interviews you've given. But I think adapting what you think your market fit is as an agency and then how you pivot to refine your footing along the way has been a real reality of ours in learning our own strengths and really what we can offer clients in companionship with what it is we're even trying to do with our mission as a studio at large.
I was going to say as well, what you've described is very circular, sharing that education, empowering consumers to actually identify what is greenwashing, what's not, to bring inherent value to these products, which obviously in turn is bringing value to clients.
Setting out really intentionally with a strong brand around our studio has allowed for a little bit of pre-vetting work on our behalf by having this message and this outward loudness around what we stand for has acted almost like a pre-filter for clients coming to us. And while our services have adjusted and changed to meet the needs of the clients, people understanding what we care about has been very evident from the beginning.
Maybe it's less of a change of what you're offering, but refinement to the clients that you're targeting.
Very much so.
That sounds really cool.
This is Lauren Menard.
This is Lauren Menard.
This is Lauren Menard.
And this is Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler. Bailey Mishler.
And you're listening to Redacted.
How did you land that first big dream client that ticked all these incredible boxes and was ready to jump in and put their money where their mouth is?
It was word of mouth and totally what we call the network effect. We meet up with fellow designers all the time. And one of our friends, Eric, we met up with him for a coffee. He was freelancing at the time. And he was like, what kind of work do you want to do that you haven't touched yet? And I think I answered, I really want to work in automotive. I feel like it matches all of our experiences of footwear, furniture, movement, materials, all of that. And then a week later, we got in touch with Lightship through him. I don't know if you've seen Lightship. It's this new EV RV that's completely wild. It has its own battery system and you can go off the grid with it.
It's actually really interesting because it's like a caravan, which is a lot more popular in Australia than an RV.
RV isn't the right way to describe it. It's just the short way to say it. But we worked on the interior of this thing from when it was just a box. Actually, they hadn't finished the exterior shell yet. And that just happened naturally. And that was our first, I'd say, big client.
I mean, it's eerie looking at it because my work is literally sitting in the bathroom.
Bathroom's my favorite part.
That little thing in the corner that haunts me like a ghost everywhere I go. I know exactly what that is. And I designed it. Great. It's following me like a ghost everywhere.
It's the little thing that makes every project look a little more high end.
There you go. You're like the seasoning on top.
When I did that bottle, and for people listening, it's a bottle for a very specific cosmetic brand, lifestyle brand. The client had specifically added one line into the brief, and it was a very brief brief. They wanted to be able to tell whether it was a render or a photograph. So there is a little feature in there that if you know, you know, and you can immediately pick out if it's a render or a photograph.
All right. Challenge accepted.
All right. I will promise a prize to someone who can email in and tell me what it is.
DM us on Instagram if you know the answer, and we'll give you a voucher to something.
I have a segue question, and I'm 100% projecting myself in this question, like nothing with you guys. I'm making an assumption. But when you went from that director space and working for other people to becoming consultants and being the experts brought in, did you suffer from any sort of imposter syndrome or pushing through that, hey, I am the expert, I'm here to push these boundaries? And how did you get through that?
Oof, I've been going to therapy for like 7 years just on this topic.
Especially when you told me that you jumped in with automotive, could you get a more intensely stereotypical ID industry to really shake up?
I'm going to let Bailey answer this question, but I'm just going to start by saying I have imposter syndrome, but I also come off as extremely confident. So I have a way of hiding those things, and I'm the first to admit it too.
Teach us. How do we do it?
I really like getting put in those arenas where I know nothing because I'm also an athlete and I feel like I like the challenge. It's almost like a drug.
You thrive off the adrenaline of the pressure.
I do indeed. But I want Bailey to give a much more interesting, thoughtful answer because she will, as always.
I think huge imposter syndrome of, for me, my journey has been jumping from so much in-house pushing to now being hired, and there's so much expectation built around that hired role. But I think something I've learned a lot in these last 2 years is that it's not a perfect science and not every day shakes out this way, but I've been learning and accepting or celebrating even that vulnerability can be a strength. It's so much baked into how we operate even as a studio. And maybe we don't articulate it this way very often, but there's so much expectation put on you as a designer, whether you've gone through formal education processes or not, that you have to know it all. When I think about even in school, where you had to know everything from the material science to the engineering to how it would be manufactured to every program that you need to use to execute it for the project. Sometimes you don't know all those things. And in the real world, you're not expected to do every single part. So I think that admitting that you don't know has played in our advantage. Even as our name, our studio name alludes to, we are hunting for answers. We are hunting for better. We are just as much on this journey for ourselves as we are with our clients. And so getting to the point where you're okay asking for help and bringing in experts and bringing in collaborators only makes it entirely better. And you learn so much more and faster by doing that.
I gather you have a lot of client meetings where you have to say, we don't know, but we will find out.
In the space that you guys work with, this cutting edge materiality of things, it must be pretty common for people to be like, wow, we've never seen this before. We're not sure. Let us work it out. Surely that's the attitude that these founders and companies are really searching for.
You know, it's funny. This could be seen as an insult really quickly. Some of our clients will say, we're hiring you for your fresh perspective. You could unpack that in a bad way and say, oh, that means that we know nothing. You know, if you were cynical and wanting to see it that way. But truly, I believe that it's because Bailey and I live and breathe this curiosity and are willing to turn over rocks that we're not sure what's underneath it. And I think it just shows and kind of oozes from our pores. When people meet us, it becomes pretty obvious that we're really interested in what their problems are. And we do always say in our client pitches that everyone's journey is different, especially on the climate front. There's absolutely no way that even if you're competitors with each other, that two brands' journeys can look the same or should look the same. So whatever worked for this client over here should probably not be used over here. We're going to have to figure out what the best path forward is. It's really time-consuming work, but it's arguably the most meaningful work we can do right now.
Absolutely. It must be so satisfying to really be able to put a line there and really calculate how much you've been able to have an impact.
We have really smart people who calculate that stuff.
There's a lot of people who would argue that pushing the needle is an even harder challenge than calculating the impact that you've made.
There's definitely this pretty big commitment to unpaid time that is us mining for more in making our own material library and reading up on the latest legislation and policies and trying to just stay as up to date as we can and have this inventory of information to pull from and point to that may not have come out of a project making us do that research, but us just needing to do it at all, that may or may not coincide with a project that we're getting hired to do.
It puts you in a great position though, right? If you're always on the forefront of this materiality, if something comes up with a client, you're almost ideally positioned to push forward these incredible new solutions. Where we live in Australia at the moment, they're doing a really big push for getting rid of a lot of single-use plastics. McDonald's, for instance, we've got no plastic cutlery. We've got the paper straws that everybody hates. And Fraser and I were talking about it the other day, the wooden spoon that everybody hates. Why haven't they made it out of pasta?
I've seen a project like that, actually. It was a student project. There's a new company.
Yeah, I'm just pushing it forward because you guys seem like you'll be in touch with people before I will. But I'm really keen for a molded pasta Sunday spoon.
There's a lot of health and safety that would have to go into that. I have looked into that. It's a legal minefield for responsibility.
Oh, boy.
It'd be a fun experience eating soup with a pasta spoon, though, because it would get really gooey as time went on.
It'd be like trying to pick up things with sausage fingers.
I feel like that's why it's perfect for the sundae. It's just going to stay nice and cold. The texture of dry pasta is fine on my tongue.
I'm into it.
Yeah, if anyone else is listening, please take it, run.
Please don't.
This is Lauren Menard.
This is Lauren Menard. This is Lauren Menard. Lauren Menard.
Lauren Menard. And this is Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler. Bailey Mishler. Bailey Mishler.
And you're listening to Redacted.
When it comes to your clients coming to you, they obviously come ultimately for your design process. What is the Prowl design process?
The process itself in steps really is not that radically different from the industrial design process, where we value each step from research, ideation, prototyping, testing the ideas, execution.
I'll also just add, I think the reason why Bailey and I work so well together is because we're completely opposites in process and in the way our brains function. I'm super messy in my design process. It makes no sense to anyone but me. And Bailey is extremely methodical and organized. And I think Bailey has gotten slightly more organic and I have gotten a little bit more structured. So we're starting to find our groove together. I had a lot of shame about my messiness in my process when we first started working together. And now I'm just harnessing it.
I think what makes us different is that we have created these 5 design principles that we live and breathe by that gets applied to the method in which we execute the project. They're all incredibly important, but 2 I'll mention are that materials are at the center of everything that we work on. Everything that is ever created is just what it's made of at the end of the day. So materials play such an integral role in what we make. And then clearly this whole conversation is us really hammering on the collaboration side and pulling in experts for any number of things, from material scientists to life cycle analysis folks, certification experts, to help be stronger in solving all of these pretty macro issues.
Really interesting when everyone talks about their process, because everyone is very similar. They're like, we go through these same stages.
They all say it's the same, and then you get into the nitty gritty and it's very different.
It's almost like everybody's lived experience and all that curiosity that you collect is the training data that the ideas are all pushed forward from.
Well, I'll just add, I think that's why working against principles really works for us so well is because each research phase we go through might look so different, and how we work through concepts, each project might look so different. I mean, sure, there's the exploration and there is some foundation that we work against, but the principles allow us to harness that qualitative side in a way that rigid step one, step two, step three maybe doesn't allow for in at least our partnership dynamic.
It's almost like you're getting the best of both worlds, brains stretching in different directions.
Hannah Montana.
Hannah Montana.
Yeah, best of both worlds.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to lie, I was thinking about that when I said it.
Would it be possible for you to list out those five principles?
They're in a magazine that's right next to me. I could read them off from the magazine.
Oh, yes, please.
I love that. What a flex. Here's what I prepared earlier.
They're written in Damn Magazine, issue 85, which is pretty fun. They did the whole feature on our studio. Number one, we give equal weight to design and its regeneration. They are symbiotic and inseparable. Number two, we place materials at the center of development. A product's journey from beginning to end is distilled to its material composition. Number three, we expect more and we need to expect more from sustainable design. It's a potent way to fortify utility, enrich performance, and protect the future. Number four, we measure success by practicality. Effective regenerative design is inherently useful, durable, and therefore valuable. And number five, we collaborate to be stronger together. Strategic partnerships increase our capacity to create a regenerative future. Going from one to five, our first principle is we give equal weight to design and its regeneration. We see them as symbiotic and inseparable. Number two is that we place materials at the center of development, which Bailey just mentioned. A product's journey from beginning to end is distilled to its material composition. And that's where we really dive deep into that begin with the end mentality. Our third is that we need to expect more from sustainable design. It's a potent way to fortify utility, enrich performance, and protect the future. What that means is that if we want to build a regenerative future, people's expectations of products aren't going to change, right? Our things work really well in our current world.
But they don't work really well. Isn't that the truth? It's all falling apart. On a surface level where people see it, it's working well. But behind the scenes, it's just shambles.
The reason for this specific principle for us is we want to challenge that. Why should we expect that something good for the planet should just fall apart?
I love that. It's a great product. It just happens to be good for the planet as well.
Exactly. Certainly, there is a lot of R&D that may take more time to develop to perform to that expectation, but we want to push that each and every time and not force our clients to have to compromise or the end user to have to compromise just because they're making a better choice for the planet.
Yeah, the conundrum here is it can't fall apart on people before they're done using it. Sure, there are certain things that came to market really early on in this environmental revolution that didn't function properly, right? Everyone knows the paper straw example, but it's a bad example because there are examples out there that are new and innovative that actually do last, and they last as long as they need to, which is key. Our fourth principle is that we measure success by practicality. Effective regenerative design is inherently useful, durable, and therefore valuable. By practical, we really mean that the world of this regenerative future, oftentimes people look at some of the work we've done at Milan Design Week and such, and they're like, oh, wow, the material's cool, but it's ooey gooey and bio mass. And they have this idea that the world of regenerative design is a gooey future, and it just doesn't need to be the case.
Like a Hitchcock Geiger future.
I'd be down with that.
Like that it only lives in speculative.
And so we use the lightship as an example of that thing has been designed extremely efficiently with responsible materials. Sometimes the answer is not something that's super innovative in material. Sometimes it's like, let's go back to basics. And then our fifth one, which is an umbrella, we collaborate to be stronger together. Strategic partnerships increase our capacity to create the regenerative future. Meaning, we almost can't name a project we've done that didn't entail bringing on some sort of collaborator We've done exhibitions where we've curated different material companies. We've brought along thinkers and storytellers. We don't want to do everything in-house. There are people who are really good at what they do. And so we find that we do our best work when we can pinpoint someone in our community or someone on the internet that really aligns with what we're trying to get after. And then we just bring them in and have them help us build what we're going after.
You talk about having advisors on your team from various fields on call. What are the advantages and disadvantages to working with these external people on these projects?
These have been some individuals who have been really key people in our professional development, even before Prowl. These people who have just enriched our lives and enrich the business that we're building. And so we've invited them in this formal way as advisors to really just be there to help us navigate a lot of what it means to start your own agency, right? I mean, as we said earlier, you don't really know what you don't know. Having these people to help us work through anything from sounding board on proposal process to the role of how we structure our research in the future, right? It's everything like strategic brainstorming of the future of our studio down to brass tacks. And I would have never done this alone. We have each other to work through a lot of these things, but having these advisors has only brought those learnings on faster in a way that maybe we didn't have to trip over ourselves or fail as much along the way.
Like with a startup, you have a board of directors. It's very similar to that. I think a lot of studios have less formal relationships that act as advisors, but we see it as these people are really important to us. That's why we list them on our website. And we do try and have very symbiotic relationships. And one of our advisors runs a nonprofit, and we've really helped him grow that in order to get to launch, in exchange for him giving us his wisdom, which is not even a fair trade. But from where we are in our life spectrum, that's what we have to offer. And we're big believers in mentorship and leaning into just listening to everyone around us. I think it's just a quintessential way that we live our lives. If someone's work is really speaking to us, we'll just DM them, pick their brains, let them pick our brains. And I think it's something that doesn't really happen in the design industry because there's a lot of fear of competition. But what's holding people back, you know?
I feel like people forget the thing they dedicated their life to, they want to talk about.
People feel good about that when someone reaches out to them and they say, wow, I really love what you do. You're going to make their day. They're going to feel fulfilled by even talking about what they do. And people really want to give more than you might expect. So that's something that we tried to tuck away, is this feeling of, oh, we owe people something, that offer up advice. It's just not the case.
And I think people can feel when somebody is genuinely interested. They're not just coming because their teacher said, go ask 6 questions. You're coming from a place where you actually do care, you are interested, you're motivated to connect with this person.
It's just that much more rich because of that. No one's forcing you to do that.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. And I think that really shows when you connect with people.
What inspired you to do this as a pathway? It's not a conventional means of getting information for a design studio. As you said, there's a fear of competition, so not everyone's super keen to share. Not everyone's super keen to talk to others. At what point did you say, no, we're going to do it a little bit differently?
We were already picking people's brains on a regular basis. I mean, as an advisor of other spaces, it feels good to wear that as a badge of honor and say that you're helping a business grow. And they were giving so much that we wanted to give this batch and say, you're helping us so much that we want to formalize this to a degree, because we believe that it's so valuable, that it's a key portion to how we are thriving and how we've gotten as far as we've gotten. Sure, in the design space, it's not normal, but you go to any new startup's website and they use that as a flex, and they'll try to find the most C-suite people they can. And luckily, we've got some ballers in our space. And Some of them are our advisors and some of them are just people who are helping Prowl because they believe in us.
Just echoing, we were already just doing it. I would say the reason for the formalities, I think, was the chance to put a little bit of structure around it and maybe allow just some governor of not asking too much, of setting some expectations, of reaching a goal together. That always feels great. Putting a little bit of
order to the chaos,
putting some parameters around it that just was respectful of everyone's time and seeing what we could build out of that. That was repeatable and high frequency.
It's almost like a commitment too, right? From your end. We appreciate it so much that we're committed to this relationship.
In a very similar way, as we just described, the people who have coached us through this personally and professionally, we have a similar part flexible, part formal going with a number of other collaborators as well, in that sometimes it's project by project and sometimes it's informational. Some of it is a little bit more formal, such as a partnership we have with a sustainability staffing agency who really helps us with the quantitative side of our projects. We have a co-business development strategy we run with them to, as our principal mentions, be stronger together in our missions.
Did you have any good stories on how you found some of these people?
Word of mouth and, oh, Bailey's laughing. When Bailey's laughing when a question like that is asked, the answer usually is LinkedIn.
That wasn't where I thought it was going.
Lauren is the most power user I know.
I'm so excited to connect Lauren.
Honestly, it's a really underutilized tool for startup businesses and designers. And Lauren's figured it out. She's cracked the code.
I haven't. There are people that are way, way, way higher on the food chain than I am. There are people with 30,000 followers on LinkedIn, but I'm just a loud person. And when I'm pissed off about something or when I'm really stoked about something, I'll post about it because I feel like it helps form your voice in a way that Instagram doesn't. And it hits your professional sphere. And I will say, I've met some of my best friends on LinkedIn just because I love what they do. I see their resume and I'm like, oh, damn, like they've worked at all those places. That's so cool. Let's have coffee. 6 months later, we're cooking dinner together in my kitchen. Anything can happen. It's a social network. And it just so happens that the connection point is work. And as a creative, work bleeds into your life in every way possible. Of course, there's the side of LinkedIn that's like, oh, I'm so proud of, right? There's always that someone will only post when they have a new job, or C-suite person will say, I'm so proud of the team. That's a very common thing. But I like when people get on there and they're like flagging something horrible that's happening in the product world, or having a really important discourse about a new material or something like that. Honestly, some of our best material partners we've also found on LinkedIn.
It sounds like I really need to update my headshots.
The picture doesn't matter. It's the content.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for it. Do you have any LinkedIn role models that you look up to then?
No.
That's the right answer.
I love it.
This is Lauren Menard.
This is Lauren Menard.
This is Lauren Menard. Lauren Menard. Lauren Menard.
And this is Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler.
Bailey Mishler.
And you're listening to Redacted.
Do you see any unique challenges or advantages that female designers might have in the industry?
We are at a constant battle with ourselves on how much to promote or not mention our female leadership role and female identity in this field, because in some ways it's worked in our favor for those after certain goals they might have as certain clients. But it's obvious that we stand out because it's so rare, and that's a bummer. And we don't really want to perpetuate the rarity and novelty of it if that were to be a detriment to the growth of it just being more equal and ubiquitous.
I think that's incredibly well said to begin with. It's a real push and pull from my perspective, which is a really privileged perspective, that I have had a lot of opportunity by being female, but that in my experience doesn't feel fair, where I know in other places people really get discriminated against. So that advantage is so important. So it's a really tricky one.
Totally agree. I mean, I just did a little bit of refreshed statistic research on the demographics, and it's grown in the last 10 years. But in the United States, at least 18% of the industrial design field specifically is female. This is maybe a touch of a tangent, but whenever I got to university, I remember my first walk through the industrial design department and just being like, whoa, this is so macho, such masculine energy. The first feeling of being in it didn't feel so welcoming, but I was so lucky, despite having fallen in love with it and entering the program, I was really, really lucky to have a class that was more female than male.
Did it give you more sense of belonging?
Definitely. Yeah, I feel like I wasn't as burdened emotionally by the gender divide in the industry a lot because of that. But that's not to say I haven't seen, heard, felt myself discrimination, but I think that did help shape some of my outlook, which I'm thankful for.
It's going to sound really bizarre, but the whole time I was at university, I didn't really understand there was such a gap between the representation. I went to quite a progressive design school where I think they actually aim for a 50-50 quota. So when you say you had a female dominated class and that was a rarity, I couldn't tell you if any of my classes were male dominated or female dominated. But there's still a huge gap between employability. I would struggle to name a handful of female people that I went to university with that have gone on to work within product specific design. Quite a few user experience, service design, but product wise, very, very few.
I'm going to share a story because I've had some pretty hellish experiences and I didn't really realize how bad they were until I was out of it. I've only had terrible bosses. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. But I feel as though a lot of male leadership doesn't understand or they're fearful on how to manage female designers because they're different, right? Some might say more detail-oriented. Also, I think there's also this thought and feeling that female designers or femme-identifying designers will bring a more feminine aesthetic. And a lot of places don't want that. But there was this one experience I had that told me all of the information that I needed. I was interviewing in the Bay Area, going from a contract position working at Specialized Bikes, Adobe, and a few other places at the time. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try this agency thing. So I interviewed at this place and I showed up and it was a boardroom of all men in this glass room. Everything was black. I mean, I love black, let's be real, but very, very stark, concrete black space. I presented my work. The interview went extraordinarily well. And then as I was walking out, pretty much felt like I had the job and that they'd be in touch the next day with next steps. They gave me this swag bag as I left. I get into my car and then I crack open this bag and I see a pin and some other things. And then I see this garment and it's pink and I pull it out and it's a logo t-shirt of the studio and it just doesn't keep coming. It's literally a belly shirt. I had been given a swag bag from an industrial design studio that had a pink crop top in it. Do I look like I want to wear a crop top? Even if I did, are you kidding me? That was not that long ago. And that was still happening. That could have made me super cynical, right? That could have sent me in a direction where a lot of women leave industrial design because it's so unwelcoming. But actually what it did is it showed me that there's so much work to be done. And I know that I have a pretty strong backbone from a lifetime of sports, I see things as challenges. So I took that and saw, all right, I need to shake this stuff up because this is not okay. And obviously I did not take the job that was offered to me, but I feel as though there aren't enough women who stay in the design field long enough to make it to management positions to then act as role models, to then be able to bring up this new generation of femme-identifying designers, which makes the world a more interesting and beautiful place. We always try to encourage young designers to stay with it. Don't just go to design research because you feel like you're being forced to the softer research side, because that does happen. Design research is super important, but women often get pushed to that, or they get pushed to CMF. they get pushed away from the CAD-driven side of design. We try to encourage these people to stay with it. And it's not coincidence that most of the inquiries we get, which are more than a weekly basis, are from young female designers who want to talk to us. They found us. They found one of the few that's owned by women who are also mission-driven.
It's so hard to tell because it could have gone either way, but it feels like it was almost a missed opportunity. Maybe that board of males were actually trying to welcome you, but there was this disconnect between what was actually a valuable welcome, what you expected and what you wanted, and how you wanted to feel in that team. And I'm putting words in your mouth, but maybe not tokenized.
Tokenized and maybe a lack of empathy?
Maybe this lack of interacting with females in a professional environment really pushed forward what they thought would make you welcome. Maybe they only spend time with women in crop tops. If they were wanting to hire you, it's hard to believe that they wanted to humiliate you with this garment as well. I'm not saying you should have worked for them or even educated them, but it feels disappointing that maybe this was the best intentions they could put forward.
With less females being in the workplace, how are we to even expect how to interact? Because there hasn't been enough practice.
Maybe these people were monsters and they did it and they should be condemned in every way possible. But maybe also we could try to find some middle ground and be like, this doesn't really make me comfortable. You can just treat me like everybody else.
Maybe on a more positive note, would you say that there's strengths that the average woman can play to, like a comparative advantage when it comes?
I really wish that when people interviewed you with the mindset of hopefully diversifying their team, they could actually identify the skills that they're expecting this diversity to bring so that they can champion that in the interview. So you feel like you've actually earned the job. You haven't taken a diversified job. Because I would say that's the biggest thing for me. I don't want to hear I got a job because I was a female or I had a favor given to me. I want to feel like I have a voice that's actually respected, not just because how I identify.
You don't want to be the office accessory.
No. I have no issue in being in a minority situation where maybe I'm the only female or I'm one of a couple. Obviously, it'd be great if there were more, but that's not going to make me uncomfortable. What's going to make me uncomfortable is not feeling valued for what I bring because nobody can identify that when they hire me other than surface level reasons.
That right there is exactly why Bailey and I struggle with how much do we play up us being a female owned studio or not.
It's a catch-22.
You want your work to be valued on its own merits.
Yes, yes. We're proud, obviously, but also just to note, this whole time we've been talking about females, but just think about how few women of color there are in the design industry. They're hard to find, probably because there's that term, you can't be what you can't see. If you don't have role models that look like you or that you can see parts of yourself in, it's a bit difficult to work towards that. I know that I just told that cynical story, but I felt like it added some color to what we've experienced. But I will say that we're noticing a shift in how people are actually prioritizing hiring women, because knowing that women are inherently thoughtful thinkers, more empathetic, generally, the list of things women are good at go on forever because we're awesome.
Also appreciating that women aren't just stereotypically good at women jobs.
There's definitely a long list of skills that at least we can speak to have worked in our advantage. And I just thought it'd be worth mentioning a couple. The ability to multitask. This isn't generalizing. This is something that's worked for us and that we've identified as a differentiator. But I think multitasking and making sense of a lot of complex situations has been a strength that we've found really works for us. And then I would also say that high pain tolerance in the early days of founding a business, this isn't easy work.
Wait, this is an emotional pain tolerance, not a physical
one. Emotional. Yeah.
We've been through some painful moments in Milan. Let me tell you, my friends, we have lifted some heavy things.
Yes. Yes.
I believe it. I've made it through some difficult paper cuts and scalpel cuts.
Redacted.
Thanks, Lauren and Bailey, for joining us on the show today. We've thoroughly enjoyed hearing about your approach to design. For the listeners, don't forget to check the show notes for links to anything we've mentioned, where to follow the show, as well as Lauren and Bailey, and our discounts from PCBWay. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, this has been Redact.
The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please check and try again. The number you have dialed has been
redacted.